Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Who Inspire. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and my guest today is Stacey Murphy, and she's written a book called The Suffrage Centennial Anthology. So, Stacey, how long have you been involved in, you know, documenting women's history?
I really am not involved in it at all. I'm not anything like an expert when it comes to this topic, but like a lot of people, a lot of women, I'm interested in women's rights and contemporary things and just interested in history in general. Basically, I'm a writer. I have a career as a grant writing consultant to nonprofits and municipalities, and just am also a creative writer. And in 2017, it was the anniversary of women gaining the right to vote in New York State. And so in talking to some other friends that also are writers, we wanted to be involved in some way. The state historical societies were all sort of looking for projects that were commemorations that would be happening around the state. And we thought this project would be good together. So Nora Snyder, who's the co-editor, and I, we solicited submissions from different writers early in 2017, and it wound up creating this anthology project.
So New York State allowed women to vote in 1917?
Yes, that's when the right to vote was granted in New York State. It happened all over the place in the different states and territories at different times. Wyoming was actually the first in the 1860s, I believe it was, and when they were still a territory. Okay. And when they came forward into statehood, they, you know, that was one of the things on their list for when they applied for statehood. They thought it would make it compelling if women could continue to retain the right to vote. And it happened in different states all over the country. And the final states to allow for suffrage for women was, of course, when the 19th Amendment passed in 1919. I'm sorry, the 20th Amendment.
When that amendment was passed, a number of states have allowed women to vote?
Yeah, for a long time women could vote if they had property, if they owned property, and they could vote in local elections, things like that. But laws were such that a lot of times women lost their property when they married, and then therefore lost their right to vote also.
Wow. And the amendment that took place in 1920 that remedied that?
Well, it granted suffrage to women in law. There's plenty of people now who will point out, rightly so, that it really kind of just granted the right to vote to white women. It wasn't until the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that vast numbers of African Americans, men and women in the South, could safely vote. I mean, it eliminated, 1965 Act eliminated a lot of the mechanisms and things that had been in place to suppress votes. So kind of in modern times, and talking about how the suffrage movement applies to modern times, there's a lot of history there that points to, you know, how things played out much differently for white women than for African American women, even though there were a number of them involved in the suffrage movement in the 1800s and 1900s.
One of the controversies surrounding the amendment was that when women got the right to vote, they would, you know, run for office in numbers and sway elections, but that never really happened, right?
I think there may be incidences of that. This is where, like I said, I'm not exactly a historian, so I'm not sure where or how that played out, but a lot of the evidence was just to the, you know, contrary. Some women voted and some women still did not vote. it's interesting that World War One seems to have played a part in it too, because, you know, women took more of a prominent role in society and in the community when, you know, more men were off voting, and Woodrow Wilson kind of saw the point in, had a factor too. He could see the point in women voting because they were more of a central part of keeping the country going.
Okay. So that's interesting. But if do you think that if there was not World War One, that it would have been later in our history that women were granted the right to vote?
I really have no idea, to be honest with you. I mean, the suffragists who worked on it back then worked really long and really hard, and there were parallel efforts going on by suffragettes in England. So, you mm-hmm. know, it's possible that maybe its time was coming anyway.
Okay, so you live in New York State, right?
Yep, I do. I live in Ithaca.
So before the pandemic hit, were you anticipating large number of people, not only in New York State, but throughout the country, to visit a lot of the historic sites in New York, for instance, Seneca Falls and so forth? But that really didn't come to pass, right?
Well, people haven't been able to, you know, hold a lot of the celebrations that have been planned. I know around here, our History Center and our League of Women Voters and a number of places, university museums and things, have been talking about having commemorations. And I think that was just some things I was seeing, looking online, that was happening around the country too. But a lot of mm-hmm. things have moved, you know, have had to move to online formats and, you know, discussions and presentations and readings trying to happen that way as opposed to, you know, in-person celebrations. But you know, I think there's still some people that are hopeful as the year goes on there may be some abilities to gather, but other uh-huh. people are not quite so optimistic. You know, we're all sort of taking it a day at a time, right?
Right. So do you think that the, you know, Zoom and all the online stuff has diminished the enthusiasm for the celebration of 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote, like just as enthused as if the pandemic never happened?
I think there's probably enthusiasm that is living on and being maintained in people, just like, you know, there's enthusiasm being maintained for a lot of other things that are going on in people's lives. It's just that, you know, you can't really do that. And also there's a lot of other things going on right now, right, in our society that we're paying attention to. But it's interesting mm-hmm. to note where some of those things intersect. Like a lot of the people who responded to the call for submissions, who submitted pieces to the anthology, they wrote more about contemporary things as opposed to talking about suffrage. What a lot of people said, either the, you know, contributors to the book and even just people, is that we were writing it and creating it and talking about it over and over again. I heard thoughts that were like my own, which is, oh yeah, suffrage, that was important, but I really don't know why, because we knew why in a global sense, but we don't know details because no one was really taught that growing up. And instead people were kind mm-hmm. of responding to it like, well, I think there's probably parallels here, because in 2017, it was right after the last election and women were feeling things. And a lot of people were talking about, relating the struggles for rights and voting rights then with, you know, the struggles and uphill battles that women are facing now, and felt like they were facing right after the 2016 election. So I think now, too, so now we are in the middle of another election year, right? And there's a lot of things going on that have to do with looking at, you know, bills that aren't getting passed that are getting held up in the Senate, that like the SAFE Act and other things that could make voting safe again for us now, that are just not happening. And there's a lot of frustration around that. And there's Me Too, and there's Black Lives Matter now, and a lot of things that are going on that are bringing a lot of rights and things to the forefront, and I think people are feeling those things and expressing those things in spite of being in the middle of a pandemic.
So basically, women's rights was born in the state of New York at Seneca Falls. So when did the idea of women getting the right to vote in the United States, when did that happen? And how did that happen?
Well, the Seneca Falls Convention was 1848. And have you been to Seneca Falls?
Gee, actually, no, I haven't, but that's on my bucket list to do.
It's really neat. There's a national park there, actually, at the site where that convention happened. It's a Wesleyan chapel, and they restored it. And when you go inside, you can just feel, like, the energy of it almost. It's pretty – it gives me goosebumps when I go in. And there's a whole museum there. And also in Seneca Falls, there's, the Women's Hall of Fame is there, which is another separate sort of museum attraction place. And, you know, historic homes like Elizabeth Cady Stanton's home and things like that. So it's definitely a cool, and it's just a neat little town. So, if you get a chance, definitely check it out.
Yeah, I live in Albany, New York. I live up the street from the state capitol. And one of the things that I've thought about over the years since I've lived here was the fact that Albany could really use a women's in government museum and to highlight all of the wonderful things that, you know, have been passed and discussed in New York State. For instance, Frances Perkins, you know, if it wasn't for her, she talked about the Triangle Fire in New York City, and because of her efforts, mm-hmm. she started the Labor Department. And, you know, it's so unfortunate living in the Capitol and not really having anything concrete to honor the women of the past who have blood, sweat, and tears, who have done everything they could to make this society better.
Yeah, I can agree. It would be nice to have something dedicated like that. One of the contributors to the book, Marguerite Kern, her ancestral family, Edna Kearns, and her daughter, Serena Kearns, had traveled around in a suffrage campaign wagon. It was called the Spirit of 1770 wagon. And she writes about that in the anthology. And for a while, the wagon itself was on display at the New York State Museum there. And she had been working on a campaign to try to make it a permanent exhibit. And I think now it's on a traveling loan situation. I'm not sure where it is. She had told me where it is throughout the year, and it's like escaping me now where it's going to be, but I think Long Island might be part of it. But for a while it was like during the 2017 centennial display that was going on at the New York State Museum, it was there then. And she was going to make it a permanent exhibit, which would be something. But you're right. I mean, there's a lot of people who in our history and the telling of it have been unsung, who've contributed to, you know, our history and our social history and things that are important that a lot of us were never really officially taught were happened, that happened, unless we've kind of gone and sought the information on our own.
So over the years, as you learn about women voting, and from the inception of suffrage up until now, from your perspective that you are, you collaborated on this book, are you happy with the inroads that women have made as far as elected politics?
I think there's certainly more to be done. I mean, there's a lot of evidence in it, in just you know, the primaries so far in the current election, until the 2016 election, I don't think I really understood how much more there is to be done. I was ignorant. I thought, okay, we're doing all right. And since then, there's been a lot more that's become evident in things that, you know, have just been sort of part of the background noise of our lives and the fabric of our living that people have been speaking out more about in the last 3 years. And it's clear, no, we really do have a lot farther to go. Like the ERA hasn't passed. There still is no Equal Rights Amendment. And without that, there's a lot of limits still on women. And that is a big unfinished piece of business, I think we have. Because if there was the Equal Rights Amendment, there would be a lot of things about women's rights, particularly like rights to govern what goes on in our own bodies, which is sort of a very basic thing if you think about it. Like I don't know of any men who are happy with being told what goes on with their bodies, but it's sort of assumed that it's okay to just tell women, sure, you know, we can pass laws and tell you what to do. And the ERA would help with that. It would help with legal battles, it would be a big step.
But it's passed in 38 states, right?
I believe so, but there's some different challenges to whether more recent votes, like in Virginia, are still legal and can hold up, because the original ERA, when it passed, there was like some time limitations on getting the rest of the states. And New York State itself does not have an ERA. There's some different Equal Protection Act clauses that are in the New York State Constitution, but New York State itself does not have an ERA. And of course, the federal one hasn't passed. And some people think it would be easier just to start over and, you know, start the national level vote all over again, even though the ERA was ratified in 38 states.
Not to start all over again. That would be a monumental feat, because it was going well until Phyllis Schlafly got her, you know, her hands on the project, right?
And that's what I've heard. I mean, I was a little girl when all that was going on, so yeah, okay. It's interesting the perspective of it. So I had heard of her, but I didn't really know a lot about her until recently.
Okay. So, As you were writing the book or collaborating with other women, when did the idea of women getting the right to vote to be in the United States?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, as far as I know, the 1848 convention was when it was first talked about and being pushed for and put into words like that. You know, women having a place and a voice in society went back much farther. I mean, the thing that comes to mind is John Adams, when he was going to the Continental Congress, Abigail Adams wrote him a letter, the letter that said, you know, remember the ladies, when you're drafting things. So, I mean, the notion has been around a lot longer.
So the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848, that was just a fraction of I don't know if revolutionary is the word, but there was also a lot of people in Europe. So it was all part of the 1848, how things were changing, not only in America, but also in Europe, right?
Yep, there was things going on other places, too.
Okay. So, as you were writing this book, what was the most stunning thing that you learned?
Stunning thing I learned? I think just the realization over and over again that there are so many parallels, and there's so many ways that we continue to fail to learn from history when it's proven over and over again we should pay better attention. There's lots of little tidbits of things I learned that I had never known. There's just, you know, there's an endless volume of details that make up our social history. And when you hear about them and think about them, you just, for me, it makes me want to know more and more. Like the time we were pulling it together, a friend was working on another piece of a book about the Statue of Liberty. And she had found out that, you know, at the time, the only women who were allowed on the island when they were dedicating the statue was, I think, the wife and I think maybe the daughter or the niece of the French architects who were there for the dedication. American women were not allowed on the soil. So there was like suffragists floating around in the bay around the Statue of Liberty, like yelling that they should have the rights to full liberty too. And, you know, Statue of Liberty was there declaring that, and they weren't even allowed to be a part of the celebration. And, you know, just little things like that are interesting to me. And the ways that there was a lot that happened back then. Like there was a lot of local people, local women who were involved that we never heard the names of. Matilda Joslyn Gage is an incredible woman. She, her family history, her family home is in Fayetteville, like right outside of Syracuse. And there's a foundation now in her name, and they've converted that home into a museum. And she was an abolitionist, a suffragist. She had ties with the Haudenosaunee, and there's a lot about that culture that feeds into, it's a matrilineal culture too, that feeds into, you know, ways that civilization and sane living can be done and make a lot of sense. And these women, people were around back then that knew these things and were talking about these things, and we don't get to hear about them in our standard textbooks and in our standard lives. And, the fabric of this country is a lot more diverse. It's a lot less white and a lot less male and a lot less war-based than we are led to believe by what we learned in school and what our children still learn in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So overall, you would say that the experience of documenting this book has really been an eye-opener for you, would you say?
It is, yeah. And I mean, and there's some contemporary experiences that we have that sort of help highlight how much there is to do. Like, from the start, we made a point of weaving intersectionality into it. And just in case listeners don't know, that's a term that was coined by Kimberly Williams Crenshaw back in the 80s, and it describes the overlapping and intersectioning, like the way that social identities and related systems work together and play out in any individual person, like as far as oppression goes or discrimination goes. So like an African-American woman will experience oppression differently than I would as a white woman, or somebody who's disabled, or somebody, you know, who's transgender or something like that. But the way it all works together is called intersectionality, and sort of an approach for going forward is to acknowledge and honor the differences between each other and work together that way and that was something that they didn't know about back then. But it turns out that's not something that we all know about and honor and respect and believe now. When we were doing the book, as we were editing it, I was working with a team of male editors, and when one of them saw that term, he said, "Oh, I've never heard of that. That must be a made-up word. I'm going to take it out." And so we had to do some work educating him on, no, intersectionality is really, it really is a thing. And he understood and he listened, and it was really, really good in the end. And it was all the better, I think, for being able to have that conversation. But I think that's just one way to sort of illustrate how, you know, the work continues and the work of history is never done, and we need to keep working and making history as we go.
So do you think that Hillary Clinton's run for president was groundbreaking?
Well, it's certainly, yeah. it felt like it at the time. It felt, you know, in separating some things about her as a candidate from just the ability to be able to vote for a woman, and the fact that it seemed like there was going to be the first woman president, that was exciting, and that was, of course, groundbreaking. In terms of, it's also, I think, was groundbreaking in terms of exposing a lot of problems with, you know, our election mechanisms and our machinery and, you know, interference in elections and things like that, that we don't seem to be paying, at least the current, you know, Senate isn't paying much attention to in any real way of guaranteeing our rights to be able to vote for who we want this time. Yeah, I think it was groundbreaking in that it just was and would have been historical, of course, to have the first female president. And it's also groundbreaking in that it shows us what ground we still have to break in order to get through some different levels of sexism. I mean, Elizabeth Warren now, I mean, there was all this talk about, well, she's not electable. She was being held up to a different standard than any of the men running. And probably you could say the same for Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar. And, you know, I remember seeing, you know, things online where people, like T-shirts you could buy that said, she's electable if you vote for her. It's just that simple. And people get, you know, there's a lot of bias and things that come to play in selecting candidates. And I think it shows us a lot of what more we have to do.
So do you think that, you know, as you wrote about the, you know, suffragette movement and the early suffragettes, do you think they would be happy or not so happy to see women's role in politics and governing today? What do you think they would think?
I think they would say, you still got some work to do and keep fighting.
Okay.
I think they would acknowledge the progress that's been made, but keep going.
Right.
They would just say, keep going.
So is your book, how could people purchase your book?
Okay. So New York Votes for Women, a Suffrage Centennial Anthology. It's available. You can find it on Amazon if you just go in and enter that. Again, it's New York NY Votes for Women, a Suffrage Centennial Anthology. You can also get it in Ithaca here. You can get it through our local bookstore, Buffalo Street Books. And in New Paltz, there's a museum, the historic Huguenot Street, that has begun carrying it. They hosted our reading a couple of weeks ago. And also, I think probably the Matilda Joslyn Gage Center in Fayetteville has some. But, you know, sort of the sort of most widespread, easiest way to do that would be Amazon.
So have you gotten orders from women all over the country, or has it just basically been in New York State?
I'm really not sure. I know there have been some from around the country. When the orders that come in through Amazon, it's in through our printer, Wasteland Press. It's all through Ingram, which is a big sort of managing company that distributes books widespread. And we get information on how many, you know, sell in the course of a year, but we don't really know where they go to or who's buying them. I know that there's some that are as far away as Arizona, because I got a message from somebody who wanted to buy them for an event they were holding this summer and have them for prizes and stuff. So I know they've been purchased as far away as there.
Okay, great. So we have just about a minute or so left. So give yourself a plug and give your book a plug.
Oh, okay. So the book, New York Votes for Women, a Suffrage Centennial Anthology. Maybe the best thing to do is read the back cover to you, because that gives a nice little overview. What was it like for courageous women in New York State to fight for the vote? What parts of our heritage, history, and herstory have we never heard before? And 100 years later, what other issues of equality are renewing the pull that many feel to speak out? In New York Votes for Women, a Suffrage Centennial Anthology, 21 women explore these questions in a variety of engaging memoirs, stories, and poems. They will leave you with fresh ideas about what the inspiring past implies for our uncertain future.
And that's a pretty good summary there. It's a really neat, really eclectic collection.
Great. So you have been listening to Stacey Murphy, who is the author, or along with other women, a book about a suffrage centennial anthology. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is Women Who Inspire. And if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, Women Who Inspire 21. Thanks, Stacey. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. I appreciated being here.
Thank you.
So, Cynthia, I was wondering, how did you start Women Who Inspire?